You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. We are doing Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM on the Sound Poetry program. I'd like to welcome Susan Rich from Seattle, a world traveler, a poet that has been in many exotic places in the world, some of which you'll see in the poems themselves with the nomenclature that tells you where and sometimes what, but definitely on the go. Moving is the way we learn. We learn by going, as Rettke said, right? And I think your poetry certainly proves that. But Susan has very prosperous 21st century life of publications. The Cartographer's Tongue, 2000. Cures Include Travel, 2006. The Alchemist's Kitchen, 2010. Cloud Pharmacy, 2014. And a new publication comes from an Irish publisher, Gallery of Postcards and Maps, which is 2022. In fact, it's just brand new in the bookstores. So you can look up Susan Rich, Gallery of Postcards and Maps, and find her book available right away. Welcome to Sound Poetry, Susan Rich.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much for having me. Especially having me on my birthday. This feels quite special.
Yes, your birthday. And we don't talk about any other numbers other than BD birthday. So let's begin, I think, with your world of travel. Most of your poems do present going places, but you're going to start out with a little bit of family lore. You're from the East Coast by birth, living in Boston. Was it Boston where you grew up?
Yeah, Boston. Brighton is a part of Boston. And that's where I was born and where I spent my first few years. And
right. And so you're going to begin to explain a little bit about your family. And tonight I travel back to Alston Street.
There's a festival in Washington, in Laconia, called the Skagit Poetry Festival, that I have attended ever since I've moved here. It was one of the joys of coming to Washington, was to discover the Skagit Poetry Festival, I think in 2000, which was their first year. And so at the end of the festival, they often run workshops that you can take with different teachers, different ideas. And I think some of your audience may know the poet Ellen Bass. This did start in a workshop that she gave. So I just want to kind of give credit where credit is due, but I take the blame. So here's the poem. Tonight I travel back to Alston Street. When my father turned 19, his father died, and no one told him the truth of dying. The ocean is for sale today, and you cannot buy it. In their corner store, kosher for Passover labels arrived unaccompanied by the rabbi's actual prayers, duplicity sticking to each can of mandarins, each vessel of sour pickles. The silences could drown a boy, could slay him down to a slip of breath, language drifting between Yiddish and English, Shabbat candles the only brightness he could rely on. Stay bright. Stay bright, he might have prayed, but probably not. Perhaps his mind played the periodic tables or bicycled down tenement avenues. Here is what he learned: to perfect invisibility, to become a statue, an American like Buffalo Bill or the Kennedys. I think of the tides that grew him, a man with a talent for happiness, and his wife, most alive, in misery. The plush and spin of their marriage, green tongues never watered enough. Angel wing begonias, my father grew in pots of vermiculite. No dirt allowed in my mother's house. No bugs. What made him do it? Every year, as winter dust tempered the sun porch, he transplanted the starts upstairs. An attic bound, they rested, dormant. Today, my father, dead 20 years, would be 93. It's hard to believe it. Were you his favorite? My father's best friend asked as the funeral broke up. And so I took it in, the same way I overheard a student on campus pleading with his friend, "Do I smell of pancake batter?" Asking as if he really needed to know. So little it takes to swim beyond the small talk and investigate the ocean floor, the coral reefs and lost sunglasses, the obscured treasures of feeling and forms of intimacy. Only once did my father tell me, "I love you." The human line of language, 3 syllables and 8 letters with 2 spaces in between. It's the in-between where I live now, the middle of middle age where I paint my house the blue-gray of Alston Street, to invite back the person who fathered me, the branch tributaries in blossom on his birthday, May 20th, where I will return to him beyond language, my ghost self and his finally speaking.
In the memory of your father 20 years ago, seems as though you came to Seattle soon after he passed away then?
More or less. I think I was in my MFA program at the University of Oregon. And from there, I went to South Africa. So I didn't actually come to Seattle till the fall of 1999 to teach at Highland College.
Okay. And you are still teaching there, aren't you?
I am. How did that happen? Longest job ever. But it's a good place.
Literature, poetry?
Poetry, literature. I am the faculty editor for the literary magazine, Arcturus, and I teach film studies, film history, and sometimes freshman English, kind of whatever's needed.
I won't ask you how young people today gravitate slowly or quickly towards poetry, but it is an interesting problem that we might have with all the technology that we have today. To go to poetry is really to be standing on the edge of understanding, isn't it? It's not always being able to enter something so easily the way people enter their iPads, their phones, and play around with those. Poetry is such a, well, there's so many obliquenesses and distances that keep you from quite grasping. And students today, I wonder how they take to it.
You know, it's changing all the time, of course, but I think poetry is definitely having a renaissance right now. And all of the kind of social media networks like Instagram, there's such a thing as the Instagram poets who post their poems on Instagram. There's some breakout young poets that have done very well. And so it may not be that they know much about Keats, but there is an understanding of poetry as expression. I try to enforce the idea of poetry as play. And there's so many resources online. The Poetry Foundation has a fantastic site where they can research really any poet they want. So it's a mixed bag. I would say I was just talking to a bookseller in West Seattle where I live, Pegasus Book Exchange. And he was telling me that in his bookstore that he's been at for over 20 years, poetry has never sold as well as it has now. And he said a lot of that is coming from young people getting interested in poetry.
We're very happy to hear that. We went to the Hugo House and we did see in the audience a lot of young people, often the friends of young poets who were presented too, of course. But even so, youth was well represented there, and that was very good to see.
Yeah, it's an exciting time.
Right. So your poem of Alston Street presents some of the ideas that repeat or show themselves resounding elsewhere, the ocean and things that are deep are well brought up. And this business of drowning, living in between, but investigating the ocean floor, I think with your mapping, your interest in mapping too, that comes through in another of the poems that you're going to read. But let's proceed to your next poem, which also is about family in many respects, going back to another time, but you're in it too. And so you can read about the women of Camelot for us.
Certainly. And this is a newer poem. This isn't in the book. So it's kind of fun to read ones that are a little bit more recent. Again, I would just say one of the things about getting older, and this seems to be a theme, is that you realize your memories of being very young are of a time that doesn't quite exist anymore. And I think that's part of what I'm grappling with in this poem, this life that I knew as a little kid. And then I just took for granted. I thought it would always be there, that there would be women like my grandmother and her friends. So it was very fun to evoke this time as I wrote this. The women of Camelot, they had bosoms, not breasts. Extra strong bifocals and lipstick so bold, they matched red hots, matched licorice. Never trust them. Over and over, as if no one was listening, my grandmother's round table called out, their fingers stained with menthols and borscht. And it didn't matter to them that their M meant everyone. My immigrants kept multiple rain bonnets sequestered in purses, iridescent butterscotch twisted in gold cellophane and blue rolls of Miss Liberty dimes, prepared for the emergency that would, they knew, eventually come. They spat out their language, said it wasn't a language, half Polish, half Russian, half guttural scream. Someone had a third cousin living in Chelsea, a maiden aunt staying in Beverly. My grandmother arrived via steerage class, 16, alone, with an idea she'd pull a sword from a stone. I had not yet learned to read when I came for sleepovers in the castle filled with widows, small bracelets of digits tattooed above their left wrists. She couldn't talk of her fog-filled samovar or the filigreed tray of glass bottles, crenellated time capsules with notes of oak moss and plum, the last drops from a war I'd never understand displayed, the scent of spirits who didn't make it out. They lived together like mirrored compacts in public housing, Boston, Massachusetts, inside a project called Camelot.
Yes, a time that a child would not really be able to comprehend, but all those magical objects that you can't forget having noticed and even perhaps played with, held, and wondered, what is this? Yeah, but yes, the immigration of our elderly grandparents or parents too, in some cases, does take you back to another age, another time, almost as you bring up with towers and crenellated time capsules, that almost to a medieval time, even way beyond an age that you're actually writing about. Yeah.
Well, Camelot, right? You know, I knew King Arthur.
Yes, sure. No, you bring that up wonderfully well. In that, it's got a mixture of the King Arthur's and, of course, the modern Camelot of the Kennedy era. Right. Yeah. Very, very interesting. Your grandmother Her friends, Menthols and Borscht. Yeah, that's nice that you have Borscht, which goes back to the redness of the lipsticks too. You've really woven quite a little color tapestry there with language, and it's very, very effective. So I think you really did succeed. I know you said you worked on that for a long time, editing it, re-editing it maybe, and yet you finally worked that out.
Yeah, I would like to say that it has one of my favorite words in the world is in this poem, and I don't know if I've gotten it into a poem before, and that's the word samovar. So that idea of the kind of Russian, often copper or maybe silver, if you come from a different economic class, where you would keep tea or coffee, but it would be a piece of an object of real display and honor that would be in the house and would be very common to have, and depending on your style. But the word samovar, it's also in English, and I feel we've sort of lost that. And the other thing I just want to mention is this was a poem that ended up in the Missouri Review online, and they asked me if I would write where the poem came from and how I felt about it. And so I don't need to go into all of that here.
Right.
But when I was at school, one of the things I think I learned not to do was you should never write about your grandmother. There's nothing more cliche than writing about your grandmother, except maybe your pet. And so it was very fun to write against that and say, I'm actually going to write a grandmother poem and I'm not going to apologize for it.
I'm just following the samovar back to my grandmother. the word you wanted so much to use, and you found it.
Made me very happy to have that word, to use that word, not let it die.
All right, so we go on to some of your other poems from another collection this time. The one from The Cartographer's Tongue. The Maparium, right? Or Maparium, library, Maperi, whichever way you want to say it. Maparium, right?
Well, I'm from Boston, and we always just called it the Maparium. So yep. I don't know if there's another way, but that's how I learned it.
The name of the building itself.
Yeah. Right? And I don't know if that's useful to sort of tell people. I feel like the poem explains what it is, but it is a particular spot. So I'll just say that. And this is one of the very oldest poems in the book, so it's kind of fun to be reading it. The Maparium, Boston, Massachusetts. In geography class, we learn the world of oceans, continents, and poles. We race our fingers over mountain ranges and touch rivers lightly with felt tip markers. Deserts, islands, and peninsulas tumble raw and awkward off our tongues. Kalahari, Sumatra, Arabia. We visit the Maparium on a field trip, a made-up word we learn for the place where the world resides. We clamor in with falling socks and high-octave squeals, Palermo, Kabul, Shanghai, exploring the globe, crossing its circumference, we take flight, touch down on the see-through bridge. The earth as it was, a time called 1932, stays in a room, retracts our breath, our lives, makes history into color and light. We look up at the Baltics, see Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, lands my grandmother left, 16 and wanting the world. I want to stay inside this world, memorize the patterns of blue that reveals the origins of every sea. A wave hitting stone is the sound my voice leaves as a pledge of return on the glass. Feet to Antarctica, arms outstretched like beacons towards Brazil, I'll take this world for my own.
You really had some inspiration, perhaps, from your early life going to places like this, noticing where in the world you might be able to travel and where roughly it is on the round globe. The one that talks about the see-through bridge, was there a very large globe that you had a means of going or walking around it on this bridge?
No, so what, you know, maybe the poem doesn't do completely and could have used an epigraph, is it, you walk into the center of the globe. It's as if you take a globe that you might have at your house or at a school, and you put a little pinprick and you walk through it. And so you're literally inside this stained glass object. And the only way to be in this object is on the glass bridge that takes you from one side to the other. And yes. Then it's concave. Is that the right word? I'm not sure if concave is right. But yes. Mm-hmm. So it really feels like you're inside the world. And as the poem says, it was never updated. So I'm there sometime in the 1970s, and it's the world of another era. And, you know, it just was kind of magnificent to see this preserved. It was a piece of art. It was famous in its time. It was commissioned by the Christian Scientists to have at the Christian Science Monitor building. But it was also, anybody who grew up in the Boston area around the same time I did, it was a field trip we all took. And I hope they're still going. It's still there. It's changed a little bit, but it's still there.
Yes. And in as much as you mentioned that it goes back to a particular time, that also leads again into the past of your grandmother and the Baltics, the origin, her origin, and coming to America wanting the world. And you want to stay inside this world. You want to be within. You're quite right. The circumference could only have been from being within, which does actually help to explain it if a person thinks about it carefully enough there. Yes. And so you also begin to bring up, although you did talk about grey-blue, that you were painting your house at one time in the Alston Street poem, you begin once again to emphasize the blue. Blue is very important for you. Does that go back to a particular origin?
I'm fascinated by color. I think color is a super important thing, and that we gravitate towards different colors. You know, I have a friend whose favorite color is orange, and I just can't understand it. But for her, that is absolutely the color she gravitates towards. In Pablo Neruda's work, he uses green, green, green. And when I started reading his work carefully and seeing, oh, it's okay for him to do that, I felt less self-conscious that blue would sneak its way into poems. Sometimes it stays, sometimes it gets taken out, but it is a color that I gravitate towards.
Yes. Well, many, many poets do. I think it's one of those colors that can't be explained easily. There are so many variations of it that once you mention it, each reader is going to be infused with another shade of blue, right? Each one has its own blue. But if you remember Wallace Stevens, he was one who I remember with the idea of blue. He says, to be blue, there must be no questions. Mm. It's an intellect of windings round and dodges to and fro. So he thinks that also the world is not quite as blue as it once was. We could call it blue 10 years ago, but today it's not that blue. It's another blue. Blue is, it's wonderful to play with colors anyway. And you do that throughout your work.
I think I'm a frustrated painter. I would love, that was one of the things I did during, you know, COVID, when we all took up different ways to keep sane. I really started watercolors and did it with a vengeance for a while, and then realized, wow, I'm really not very good. And in a way that was very freeing. It was like, I'm not showing it to anybody. I'm not trying to have an exhibit of my watercolors. So I think there is something about being a frustrated painter.
Well, that's right. Most artists are somewhat frustrated about poetry too. So artists, it goes with art, doesn't it?
Well, it also goes with childhood. You know, if we think about it, in childhood, hopefully the schools are still teaching the arts, and there was nothing that had to have a special quality. You didn't have to be a certain person with a certain talent. Or I think about Ireland, where I've been at tables where people just start singing and nobody's self-conscious about whether they have a great voice or not. It's just that's part of the culture, is music and song. So I'm concerned when my students tell me, oh, I'm not very creative, or I don't have a large enough vocabulary to be a poet. I'm like, you're a person and you've had lived experiences and your life is worthy of being made into art.
Yes. Use the best of them. Just work at it. Find the treasures that you already know. Yeah. And you're going to start telling us a little bit about your life of travel in nomadic life after the Maperium. This comes from the Republic of Niger, where you had lived for some time. Was this in the Peace Corps?
Yes, I was in the Peace Corps in the Republic of Niger in the 80s. I lived in a town called Zinder, and it was my first teaching job. And it was an experience like I'd never been to Africa before. So it was new.
Nomadic life.
Nomadic life, Republic of Niger. When I come back with the cups of tea, the sugar bowl has been emptied. My imported M&Ms gone. Flies stretch their legs, search, then spiral in a dust storm of light. Aisha sits solemn in afternoon heat, examines the inside of ice cubes, what makes water strong or weak. We invent common words between us, point at the refrigerator door, the photograph of ferns rising out of snow, the last volunteer left behind. I'd like to trade with her my typewriter keys for the way she navigates the desert, reads the coordinates of sand. I want to know, as Aisha knows, when it's time to follow the ambivalent line of landscape, keep faith in dunes that disappear. By evening, when she tastes my color-coded chocolates, shares them with her friends, we both will recall the nomad, the other woman we each might have been.
Your wish for beginning to learn some new senses, the senses that your young student, was it, Aisha?
No, Aisha was actually a mother of one of the nomadic kids, and the nomadic kids didn't go to school, so it was a whole other world that I was inhabiting. But after her son had been coming to my house for lunch for many months, I assume she wanted to know where her son was spending his afternoons. So she showed up by herself. And I'm not even sure right now how we communicated in terms of that she was Sa'a's mother, but I knew that she was. And we didn't have a common language. Her language would have been Fafulde, and I wouldn't have had any Fafulde. So we had, you know, tea and snacks, and it was something that I remembered, and just two women who were from completely and utterly different worlds that normally wouldn't be connecting, but were connecting over her son, who I was very close to.
Yes. And he spoke English.
No, he did not. Okay. He spoke Fafulde and some French. So again, a lot of this was finding gesture and relationship. But we were able to communicate, and he came so often that we got to know each other, but it was through French.
Well, the inland country, Niger, not often spoken about, although it's had its independence and it's also had its troubles, but an exotic place, a land of deserts, as you say, and a different sense of knowing how to go, how to move, what directions might be the safe ones. Yeah. And you wish to know that because you come as a stranger and you have some objects of culture, civilization, the keys of your typewriter. Your typewriter you might be able to offer, but you want to know stranger things and from another sense, other senses. Yes. And that is the wonder that I think comes through in these notes of travel in your poems, that we still have to question with so much we don't know about the world. You've been listening to Sound Poetry with Susan Rich, and I've been your host, David Gilmore.